Good afternoon, and welcome back to, or welcome to Line 1, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. It's welcome back to me. I've been gone for a week or two, and it's nice to be back in the slot here. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, we're going to talk about foodborne outbreaks, and mention in particular that for various reasons, some Alaskans have been choosing to ingest raw, unpasteurized dairy products. This activity has recently been associated with two outbreaks of some serious illnesses. And so on this program, we're going to discuss the risks and benefits of ingesting raw, unpasteurized dairy products. And we'll be discussing these with the physicians and that have investigated these outbreaks, and also an expert on any investigations of foodborne outbreaks who just happens to be visiting the State Health Department this year or this week. My guests are Brian Yablon. Brian is an epidemiologist with the state of Alaska, the division, the section of epidemiology. And he investigated this year's raw milk outbreak. And also involved in that investigation was Dr. Bob Gerlach, who is the state veterinarian for Alaska. And then Bill Keene is here. Bill is an epidemiologist working at the state of the Oregon State Health Department, and he is an epidemiologist as well, and has been described to me as a foremost expert in foodborne outbreak investigations. Is that true?
I've worked on a few over the years, so.
Welcome to each of you. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Let me remind listeners just at the beginning here, if you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us. There's two phone numbers. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Before we get into these specific investigations and the illnesses associated with ingestion of raw and unpasteurized milk products, I would like to take the opportunity to kind of talk a little bit about public health with you guys. We've got some very important people here that know about public health. I don't, in my mind, feel like the public really understands sometimes what's happening with public health, who's doing it, what kind of things are being done kind of behind the scenes. So who wants to kind of help me understand or help the listeners understand a little bit about public health?
Sure. Well, this is Brian Yablon. I can take the first stab at that, and I'm sure both of my co-guests would like to weigh in as well. So I think public health, as opposed to the practice of clinical medicine, the main difference is just an emphasis on the scope. And so clinical medicine, you're talking about practicing with individuals, doing a well child check, doing a health health physical, or seeing someone for a disease concern. And public health is really about kind of the overall wellness of society. So fundamentally, health is not just the absence of disease, but it's also the presence of factors that are associated with wellness. And so public health is involved in promoting all of those factors. And so currently, public health efforts focus on, for example, prevention of obesity, focus on making sure that children have access to immunizations and have access to clean water. Historically, public health really focused on sort of societal hygiene, figuring out that when people were coming together into crowded urban areas, that there was a lot of disease that was happening because of unclean, unsanitary practices. This was even before the time that the germ theory of disease was really established. Mm-hmm. And so public health was involved in figuring that out and in applying measures to make sure that water was clean. And that really has been associated with huge increases in the average human lifespan. So historically, public health has made a lot of accomplishments. And currently, public health is sort of involved in, again, a broad measure of disease prevention, promoting health, and we do surveillance of diseases so that we understand kind of the statistics of diseases around the state and the country.
Yeah, Bill, that was pretty good. You got anything you want to add to that?
Well, I would agree with that. I'd certainly say when you go to the doctor or the nurse practitioner, it's usually because you or your child has got some illness and you want treatment. They're focused on helping that person get better. But a lot of these illnesses have consequences for other people, and they may have origins that are outside the individual. So if your child is in a daycare or childcare setting and they have shigellosis, that can easily spread to other children. So the clinician is focused on making the kid better But the health department, when they get involved, is there to make sure that other kids in that setting don't get exposed to either that child or a common setting. If there's a pattern of illnesses in a community, quite a few people coming down with something, the health department there, when they learn about this, can look for what's behind all this. So it's one thing to keep treating people, but if the problem is a failed water system, a drinking water system for a city, or a commercial product that's contaminated that may be being sold around the country, mm-hmm. The individual clinician is not in a position to work on that. But that's what the health department
or
does.
Even recognize it.
Or even recognize it, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I see someone with vomiting and diarrhea. It's not, you know, I don't think on the public health standpoint, I think, is this something I can intervene with, yet maybe there are 100 other people who've all visited some place who all have the same symptoms. It becomes a bigger issue.
And a lot of these illnesses also have roots in the environment, in their animal exposures, their environmental mm-hmm. exposures, not directly to other people. But again, public health experts generally see all that as their stomping mm-hmm. ground.
And Bob, you're a state veterinarian, and many years ago, I was up here as an epidemiologist as well before I went into private practice, and we did not work very closely with the state veterinarian, and now that's become a new paradigm, so to speak.
Yeah, that certainly is. I mean, I think there's been a greater focus on a one health concept with respect to understanding diseases, knowing that the diseases, a lot of the diseases that animals can carry can be transmitted to people, and they can be transmitted either directly or through food products or even through the environment. So, and oftentimes, you know, the public health folks are not necessarily involved with the management and production of animals, so that they may not realize the implications of some of these introductions that can happen. And obviously, veterinarians oftentimes may not be aware of what happens after that disease enters into the public health venue. So this collaborative effort has been a big introduction and a big change of the paradigm. And I think it's been emphasized with the number of foodborne outbreaks, as well as the recent salmonella in the baby chicks, and people being exposed to those and the disease then spreading from the chicks to young children and then among families. So I think it's given us all a new way to look and understand diseases and know that they cross these different avenues.
Without, I don't know, without overstating the fact, we are living longer and healthier than we ever have in the history of civilization. And there, we could argue a lot of reasons, but it seems to me, as being outside of the public health realm right now, that the public health has had a huge role to play. I think about fluoridation of water supplies. I think about promotion of immunizations. I think about monitoring HIV, tuberculosis, and some of these things that were killing a lot of us before we got very old in the past. Am I overstating that, or is that fair to say?
No, I think a lot of it, we like to take credit for a lot of that in public health, but some of it is just general public health engineering. I mean, frankly, the development of sewer systems and septic tanks and the efforts that have gone into civilization over the last few hundred years, at least, of separating people from human and animal waste in their daily life has gone a long way towards removing people from some of those risks of those illnesses, reducing those risks.
You're trying to foreshadow this program here with that, aren't you?
Not necessarily, but I think that, you know, safe drinking water and safe disposal of waste, solid and human and animal waste, has been a big part of the improved health of populations.
Right. But it was public health, in a sense, also that took advantage of all the data that came in and could promote the changes that were necessary to advance these kinds of things, either on a political sense or some legislative sense and so forth. Usually it's public health that are pushing those initiatives.
That's certainly a lot of what epidemiologists do, which is gather data on a population scale and try and make sense of the patterns and use statistical compilations and analyses to look for and try and understand those patterns.
And so epidemiology, just to get into another word that we may throw around here, what does that mean?
So epidemiology is the study of patterns of of illness and disease, the understanding of what is a normal or typical rate of disease, and the understanding of when that rate is exceeded, and when you're talking about having an outbreak or an epidemic. And so epidemiology really relies on having good quality data and on looking at the trends in data. And then the application of epidemiology relies on understanding when you're outside of the norms of what you expect and when that's unusual and you need to investigate that further.
How's that data accomplished? What's the mechanism whereby we know what the baseline rate of certain problems are?
Well, so taking Alaska as an example, there are certain conditions that are reportable to public health. And so there's a legal obligation when people have certain diseases like tuberculosis, pertussis, as well as some of the foodborne diseases that we'll be talking about today, Campylobacter infections and E. coli infections, that when those are diagnosed, a laboratory notifies our state section of epidemiology that this pathogen has been identified. Clinicians and their offices or hospitals notify us. And so that's one basis of collecting data. And then in terms of other sources of data, vital records, you know, birth and death registries, those are other sources of data that are used.
All right. So basically, we want to now, or I would like to move on into this issue of raw milk and pasteurization that we have alluded to a little bit in when Bill Keen was commenting on the fact that animals sometimes are a source of infection to humans. And as Bob has alluded to, I think, or vice versa, sometimes that can happen as well. So what is pasteurization? Let's just start there. And what's the purpose?
Well, I think you bring up a good point, because oftentimes people think of pasteurization as was developed specifically to control foodborne diseases, but there was probably a two-point process to that. The food industry actually pushed toward pasteurization, not just to control foodborne illnesses, was actually to go ahead and increase the shelf life of that product so that it could be put on the shelf longer, have a greater return, financial return to the industry. Mm. And so that some of these things, that these advances that we see are not totally related just to the public health side, but also to the development of a good, safe, or a long shelf life of a product. Mm. And pasteurization in the process, was developed many years ago, and the primary purpose was to go ahead and decrease bacterial numbers in products. And like I said, both to go ahead and decrease those foodborne pathogens as well as to increase the shelf life. And it was used for juices, wines, and other beverages besides milk.
How long ago was pasteurization started? Let me get some feeling about how long we've been doing this. Anybody, or was it the 1920s or,
I think the
it's
first
more than 200 years was the first really? Time that pasteurization. And so again, I think just to clarify, pasteurization typically refers to a heat killing
right.
step, raising the temperature up to a certain temperature point for a certain amount of time that basically results in a several log reduction of bacteria that are in the product that you're talking about. So that really kills off 99.99% of milk. And so it a couple of hundred years ago, people in England were initially using pasteurization, and then in the 1800s, I think individual level farmers were at various times using pasteurization. But then Bob could probably speak to when pasteurization became essentially universal in the United States.
Yeah, I think when I looked it up prior to coming to the show, the first recorded use of it was in 1887, and so Brian's right. It's been around for a long time period to go ahead and decrease those bacterial numbers. And then early 1900s in the United States that it was used to prolong the shelf life of milk and to decrease those bacterial pathogens. And we did have, at that time period, a number of zoonotic diseases that were going on in the cow population that was a concern, both tuberculosis and brucellosis that can both be spread by pasteurized or by raw milk. And so the pasteurization process was used to control those. And later, there's a number of different processes the milk can go through, different heat treatments, both time, pressure, and exposure to that. And so what they generally look at a pasteurization as a heat equivalent. So you either have a low heat for a long period of time. I think it's like 145 degrees for a 30-minute time period, or upwards of 171 degrees for a 15-second time period to go ahead and get what, like Brian said, is that log reduction of those, not all bacteria, but specifically those foodborne pathogens.
And I guess it rings similar to the advice you would give to someone who's cooking turkeys or some poultry animals, is to, you're trying to decrease the likelihood of people getting infected. And this is more of a public health approach across the board for dairy products, though.
A lot of pasteurization is really just another example of infection control. And a lot of this goes back into the 19th century and even into the 18th century, as people began to appreciate what we call sometimes the germ theory, which is, in other words, that there are a lot of microorganisms, bacteria, viruses, parasites, and they're around us all the time. They're on our skin. They're inside our bodies. They're on our food. They're on the doorknob. They're everywhere. And people began to recognize that some of these were causing the illnesses that were wreaking havoc with people. Pasteurization is named after the French microbiologist Louis Pasteur, who was doing work with wine and other beverages. But Lister, the guy that Listerine is named after, was discovering that if you continue to operate on people without sterilizing the surgical instruments, you could cause horrific infections from person to person. And it's all, again, the big picture is that there's microbes throughout the world. And to the extent that some of those get on us, that we swallow them or we inhale them or we get them on our skin, some of those cause illness. The fact is, most of them don't. Most of them don't cause illness all the time. As I said, we're all covered with bacteria and parasites, and most people really don't want to know about it, but they are all around us. And they're in the animals that we're with, and wild animals and domestic animals and everywhere.
And I think it's a good point because, you know, the pasteurization process for milk is so important because milk is such a, as it is, a complete food. It's loaded with protein, fats, minerals, and vitamins, and at a neutral pH, which makes it a great media for growing bacteria, all sorts of bacteria. And so there is really needed to be a kill step to go ahead and provide that long shelf life that you can go ahead and have that product in your house for that long period to consume it safely, as well as stop that transmission of diseases from the farm where it's harvested to the table.
Let me take just a second, remind listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, and we're talking about, we're working towards a discussion of some outbreaks of illness associated with unpasteurized or raw dairy products. And at this point, we're just working our way through some public health issues what we mean by pasteurization. During the program, if you have questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So I'm going to assume that almost every state now has, and maybe nationally, there are laws that say certain products have to be pasteurized or treated to prevent the or to delay the onset of a number of bacteria that might cause illnesses. Is that true?
Yeah, it was in 1987 that the FDA first put out the Interstate Milk Ordinance that wouldn't allow the distribution or sale of raw milk or raw milk products across state lines unless the milk was pasteurized. Mm-hmm. And that raw milk product would exclude cheese because they decided that a 60-day fermentation period for the cheese or aging period for the cheese would be the mitigation step or the bacterial kill step to go ahead and make that a safe product for consumption.
Yeah. So I was going to ask, what's the downside? I always like to think everything's got positive and negative aspects to it. What's the downside of pasteurization? There are some things that bacteria do that help people digest milk products and or make cheeses. So how do we balance this?
Well, I think you want to, just to start it off, I think there's a difference between pasteurization, that are just decreasing bacterial numbers, and sterilization, which will remove those bacteria as well as all the spores. And if you sterilize a milk product or heat it to that extent, you do cause an abnormal taste, and there is an unusual taste to it. Oftentimes, that's why you find the ultra-pasteurized milks that are out on the market, or sterilized products that are on the market, are generally flavored. So pasteurization is a way to heat that milk while maintaining all the nutrients of the original product and the taste. I think the desire that people want raw milk versus pasteurized milk is primarily they say there's a difference in taste of that product.
You know, I'm envisioning, I came along after the laws came into effect, but I'm sure there must have been an argument. I'm suspicious that there was an argument that this is going to be dangerous to people to pasteurize. It's going to change the foods in a way that is not healthy, just like we're hearing the arguments about genetically modified foods at this particular time. Are there downsides from the pasteurization standpoint that make the foods less tasteful, as far as we know, less nutritious, more harmful? Yeah.
Well, let's back up a second. I mean, all the milk starts out raw. I mean, when it comes out of the cow or the sheep or the goat, or for that matter, a camel or a person, it's raw milk. And if it's used commercially or distributed to other people for consumption, it gets, it may be from one cow or maybe from a pool of 1,000 cows. And most milk, the vast majority of milk that's sold and consumed today in the United States, is going to a commercial dairy, which is going to send it on for pasteurization processing. And the reason is that 100 years ago, when that was not true, most of the milk that was consumed was not heat treated. And it was recognized by people in public health and in the community at that time as a common source of illness, sometimes animal illnesses, sometimes from human handlers. And a lot of the hygienic conditions that were common on farms, dairy farms at the time, were very poor. And it was very common for milk to be heavily contaminated, and that led to a lot of horrific illness and death in people. Now, that has not been true for a long time, in part because of greatly improved hygiene conditions at most dairies around the country. But it was recognized in the 20s and 30s and even into the 1940s that that was not sufficient, and there was an impetus that came along to add pasteurization as a requirement. To this day, pasteurization became sort of the standard, more for commercial reasons rather than it was required by law in a lot of places. In about half the states, including Alaska, raw milk is perfectly legal for sale. In the other states, it's restricted to some degree or a considerable degree. It's set up by the state. Interstate shipment, as was mentioned, of shipment of raw milk for consumption was banned in the 80s.
And the evidence is that since pasteurization has come about, the number of illnesses associated with drinking milk has decreased. There's been some evidence of effectiveness of this policy.
Yeah, so in reading a systematic review published just a couple of years ago in the Journal of Food Protection, there were estimates that in 1938 in the United States that a quarter of all foodborne outbreaks were attributed to dairy products. And more recently, in the start of the 21st century, that number has dropped to perhaps 1%. And so pasteurization has been associated with a huge drop in foodborne outbreaks. And the kinds of diseases that have already been mentioned that were associated with a lot of those outbreaks. Again, we don't think of it these days, but tuberculosis could be transmitted from animals to humans. Brucella, which is fortunately an uncommon infection here in the U.S., but when people see it, most clinicians, the first thing they'll think of is, did this person drink any raw milk? Were they traveling out of the country and drinking raw milk? And then there's the more conventional organisms that are still the causes of a lot of raw milk-associated outbreaks, namely Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter, Listeria. Those are the most common causes of raw milk outbreaks.
So, and those are the common bacteria that we're associated with, and which good pasteurization practices will go a long, long, long way in preventing those kinds of infections. As you've implied one time, Bill, is the other thing, even after pasteurization, there still could be steps that could lead to contamination of products. So it's not the sole answer.
We had an outbreak of salmonellosis that we investigated just a few years ago in Oregon. It was fascinating, and I'll spare you the details because you've only got a short, you don't have a five-hour program here. But suffice to say, we accumulated dozens of cases over months, and we worked trying to figure out this. And we finally did solve the mystery, and it was due to milk from a pasteurized milk from a commercial dairy, just like the kind you would buy. In fact, people did buy in Walmarts and Safeways and Albertsons. And it turned out that the problem was not a failure of their pasteurization equipment, but actually was contamination of the outside of the containers. There's nothing wrong with the milk, in fact. They had birds that had nested in some of the equipment that was contaminating what was washing the plastic cases they hauled stuff around. So containers were getting salmonella on the outside of the plastic or paper. Weird things happen, and it's not always exactly what you think when you start out.
All right, we're close to halfway through the program, so what I'm going to do now is just take our midpoint break and remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to rejoin my guest, Dr. Brian Yablon of the state of Alaska. He's with the Section of Epidemiology, Bob Gerlach, who is Alaska State Veterinarian, and Bill Keen, who's an epidemiologist visiting from Oregon. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. And today we're discussing the risks and benefits of ingestion of raw and pasteurized dairy products. We've spent most of the first part of the program kind of discussing pasteurization, the laws, a little bit about public health and epidemiology, and we're going to get into some two recent outbreaks that have occurred and see what we can learn from those outbreaks to share with the public. My guests are an expert in the area of illness outbreaks, Dr. Bill Keen, who happens to be visiting from Oregon, and the state of Alaska epidemiologist who investigated one of these recent outbreaks, Dr. Brian Yablon, and with him in that investigation was the state veterinarian, Dr. Bob Gerlach, and he is here as well. You can reach us by emailing at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433, and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. A couple of little other details. Anytime you want, you can go to alaskapublic.org, click on the Line 1 button, and you can go to our program. We have a number of links to information about the outbreaks that we've been discussing, information about pasteurization and raw milk, and any of our other prior programs can be found at that same link to be listened to at any time. And also, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday evenings, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer your questions at that time. Bob, you mentioned the CowShare program either before the program or once we got going. I can't remember which. So what is a CowShare program and how does it relate to what we're talking about?
Well, in many states that to prohibit the sale and distribution of raw milk, like we have the rules in Alaska. The rules were established not to necessarily prohibit a person who owns an animal from drinking the milk that their animal produces. And the cow share program and these, or cow or goat share programs, were established so that a number of people could own or lease or take shares in this cow in a way to have a legal ownership of the milk product produced, and in that way get access to raw milk. And that was, we've got a number of them established throughout the state that that are in operation and work that way.
And we're going to get into reasons why people may want to do that in a little bit more. But before we do that, let's talk about these at least a couple of the outbreaks, or the most recent ones. And Brian, you were involved heavily. You want to tell us a little bit about the most recent one?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. And I think it illustrates some of the key partnerships that we in public health have and how we go about doing disease surveillance. So mid-February, we got a call in our office in the section of epidemiology from our state public health laboratory that they had identified four cases of something called campylobacteriosis. In other words, infection with a strain of bacteria called campylobacter that they had isolated from people's stool samples. And what was interesting about these cases is that all four were a match. They were they ran a specific test called a pulsed field gel electrophoresis, and this kind of breaks down a lot of the key proteins in the bacteria into a series of bands. And when they looked at all of these bands, they lined up identically for all four isolates. And that is a big red flag. And so they called us to let us know we have four isolates from the same week, and they happen to be from the same geographic area, which is the Kenai Peninsula, of Campylobacter infections. So first of all, that's a large number of infections in any week for Campylobacter. Secondly, they were all from the same area. And third, they were an exact match with this pulse field gel electrophoresis. And then we have partners in local public health who, whenever one of these reportable conditions comes up, we'll do an interview. These individuals had had disease interviews, and a couple of them had identified exposure to raw milk. And then when we went back and further did more in-depth interviews and case finding, we figured out that everyone had had raw milk consumption, that in fact the raw milk was all from the same farm. Mm-hmm. And these individuals who were sick were in different towns on the Kenai Peninsula and had no other real point of contact with each other. And so all of that was immediately suggestive that this was an outbreak associated with raw milk distribution.
And the presence of the stool samples that were tested were sent in by healthcare providers on the Kenai Peninsula. Is that how they originally got to the state?
Yeah, exactly. And so that actually brings up another good point. So if I think probably most of your listeners and myself, we've all had gastrointestinal illness, right, at one time or another.
Right.
And most of the time, you don't go in to see a provider. So you think, what would make me go in to see a provider? Well, if your young child were sick, you might be more inclined to bring them in than if a healthy adult were sick. If you had severe symptoms, you might be more inclined to go in. But in general, GI illnesses can present with a spectrum from mild to severe illness, and a lot of people with mild illness are not going into the doctor, and if they do, are not giving a stool specimen. So the fact that you get four stool specimens in the same week that all have the same match either implies that this bacteria is causing a severe infection, or that there are a lot of other infections that are out there that we actually don't know about, which is most likely the case. Mm-hmm. But these were all submitted by healthcare providers down the Kenai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. So that tweaks the public health button.
Yes.
To say, what the heck is going on? Bill, when you hear about Campylobacter, does it make you think about a particular source? Brian's already said that they identified a common potential source as being a dairy, but is it always dairy products with Campylobacter, or is that?
Well, most of these bugs have well-recognized niches in the animal or kingdom or the environment. Campylobacter specifically is linked to a number of things, including raw milk, but it's certainly poultry, turkey, and chicken is thought to be one of the leading sources of it. It's common to find it. It's depressingly common to find, if you were to go to the supermarket and pick up a package of chicken and test it, the odds are better than 20 to 40, sometimes even 50 or 60% likely that you can find Campylobacter or Salmonella or both. But it is certainly common in other animals, not just in poultry. It's common in cattle. It's common in goats and pigs too, I believe. So finding it in meat or in what you're where it is, these are intestinal bugs. These are things that would live in the guts and be mm-hmm. shed in the manure of those animals or of an infected person. Mm-hmm. And so when you get manure mixed into anything, be it water from the stream that's running past a field or lettuce that's being grown in a field or you name it, anything, that's potentially a source. Campylobacter does pop up a lot in raw milk-associated outbreaks and occasionally in cheese-associated outbreaks, but it's by no means the only thing you can find there, nor are dairy products the sole source of it.
Okay. So now you got four people that are sick, a common potential source.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do about that?
Yeah, so a few different steps in the investigation. This is sort of a branch point. So at this point, we're already pretty clear that there is an outbreak, meaning that we have multiple cases of an illness tied to a likely source. And so really the goal is to prevent additional illnesses. And one step in that is to figure out, are there other people that are already sick? And so one way of doing that was to call all of the people who had been our initial case patients, see if other people in the household were ill, see if any friends or associates who had consumed raw milk were ill, and this even before we identified raw milk, just to see if any close mm-hmm. contacts. And actually, in that process, we figured out that a close contact of one person who had shared milk with that person also gotten sick, and that was the only interaction that those people had, was the sharing of this milk from that farm. So that also kind of made it much more clear that that was the likely source of the outbreak. And then by doing calls, we got local medical providers and the local public health staff down in the Kenai Peninsula in the loop and aware that there was an outbreak going on. And within 48 hours of us getting this initial call, we already had gone with a press release to let people know that there was an outbreak going on in the Kenai Peninsula, likely associated with raw milk. And we wanted to make sure that people were aware of that risk. So if they were drinking raw milk, that they were home pasteurizing it, or they were at least aware that that was a risk that they could have with this particular raw milk product. And then we also wanted to make sure that if clinicians were seeing these infections, that they were reporting them to public health, educating their patients, and getting stool samples. And then during the course of that, we ended up doing additional press the following week. We were able to get, by getting in touch with the farmer, as well as the farmer had some coordinators in different towns that were sort of responsible for distributing the milk once the farmer got the milk up to a certain location. And we were able to contact several of the people that got raw milk from the farm. And by doing that, we were able to find additional cases. And so families had illnesses during the same period in typically late January, where they said everyone in the family had, quote, the flu. Mm-hmm. But I think what a common misconception is that when people have a bad stomach bug, that's the flu. And I think the last time we were on your show, we talked about that the flu is it's a respiratory illness with fevers and chills and body aches, but you have a cough. And mm-hmm. These people didn't have a cough. They had vomiting, diarrhea, severe abdominal cramps, and they were ill for multiple days. And whole families were sick for 3 days up to a week. And again, this association with drinking that raw milk product. And so after doing all this additional case finding, we figured out that there were at least 31 individuals who were ill with this infection. And we also identified some people who had more severe illness, including a couple who were hospitalized and four people who have some longer term symptoms of arthritis that have had arthritis for a couple of months after the Campylobacter infection, which is a known complication, unfortunately, of Campylobacter.
So, you know, most of the illnesses that I see that walk in with vomiting and diarrhea, I'm thinking it's person-to-person transmission, okay? I keep in the back of my mind, oh, yeah, maybe this is from McDonald's, or maybe it's from, I don't think about unpasteurized milk maybe as much as I should. How do you know? How do you distinguish quickly in your investigation that it's not person-to-person versus a foodborne? Or a point source, or, well, foodborne.
Short answer to that is you don't always do it very quickly. But being an epidemiologist means being a medical detective. So when we get evidence like this kind of lab testing that cases may be related, or you get a bunch of cases popping up at the same time in a small town. And again, we know from our disease surveillance that the background rate is we'd normally expect to see one a year. So when you get three or four in a week, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that something's going on. So we'll do this process of looking into the cases, and that usually involves interviewing people or their parents, finding out about the exposures, and depending on what the illness is, you know, we'll be asking about foodborne exposures or airborne exposures. In the case of Campylobacter, you'd be asking about food and things you ingested, water and dairy products, poultry and all that. So if they had all said they were eating chicken, or they'd all been to the same wedding reception, or they'd all been swimming in the same pool within a few hours of each other, these are the kind of clues that you could pursue then to see if that might be the source of their illness. And it's common for people to report a number of potential exposures.
Right.
But some of these are much more suggestive, if you will, than others, because they're relatively uncommon behaviors that are previously been linked to these kinds of illnesses. So if somebody said, well, we interviewed a bunch of people in Anchorage and they all said they'd been drinking water from the tap, you know, at first blush, you wouldn't want to jump to the conclusion that, well, drinking tap water is the source of their illness, even if it was common to all of them, because it's common to everybody who lives in or mm-hmm. visits Anchorage. Mm-hmm. But if they say they've been doing something relatively uncommon, like eating at a little tiny restaurant in one corner of town that most people would never have heard of, and they've all been to the same restaurant, or they've been drinking milk from a particular farm that, you know, very few people would get milk from, those are the kind of things that don't seem like coincidence, and they can be pursued then for additional corroboration.
And there were no cases that were not associated with this particular dairy and the milk sharing situation. So
correct.
There's nobody else out there that had no association with this that also had Campylobacter.
Correct. So of the 31 cases, 7 of which have that lab confirmed fingerprint, and right. the vast majority of the rest did not submit stool samples.
So these are not just Campylobacter. These are identical twins, almost Campylobacter.
Exactly. I mean, this is so that PFGE pattern, you know, that band pattern, that's like a fingerprint. And yeah. these are all exactly the same bacterial fingerprint. Okay. And 29 had consumed the raw milk, and 2 lived in the same house with someone who consumed the raw milk and basically were had very close contact with a household member.
Probably was a person-to-person transmission.
Yes.
Secondary. Mm-hmm. So how does the state vet get involved then?
Well, when
we called Bob right away.
And it's oftentimes a great collaboration when you go in and especially going back to work with the farmer and collect samples on the farm to look at different areas of collection and especially the milking process itself is pretty complicated and so we go down to look at the equipment to look at the health of the animals, because there can be a number of ways that bacteria can be introduced into the milk. The cows actually can shed that bacteria, that Campylobacter, directly into the milk without being ill or sick themselves. Or you could get that contamination, like Bill suggested, with the secondary contamination, either from some fecal material or some other contact with a product after it's harvested. So when you go down and have a couple eyes looking at that process and that farm, you may be able to go ahead and, one, give the producer some keys into the proper handling or management, and then others try to collect samples to identify the bacterial contamination.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, years ago when I was an epidemiologist, I did not realize and appreciate what I hear you all saying is you're trying to work with these people. You want to have a good relationship because you want to try to do something to educate this person from having this happen over and over again, and so you're trying to keep some fairly good rapport. I remember got myself into trouble really quickly by how I approached one situation one time. So to stop this outbreak, you then were trying to work with this particular organization, this particular dairy, this farmer, how they were doing things to figure out how it was happening to try to stop it from happening in the future.
Well, and that's I think you bring up a good point, because no matter the studies that have been done, and I'll give you an example. There was a study done in 2002. It was repeated in 2004, where they went to grade A dairies and they went to the bulk tank and they just dipped into the bulk tank, which is where all the milk gets concentrated until the processor comes to pick it up to pasteurize it. And they just looked for bacteria, foodborne bacteria. So in anywhere from 2 to 9% of those, well, actually it was about a third of those farms that they went to, and there was one study was 280 farms, found at least one raw foodborne bacteria in that milk. And so the incidence of whether it was salmonella or campylobacter was anywhere from 2 to 12%. And so you think these are some of the best dairies and under the best situation in sanitation, and you still find it. So that I think the point is that there's always going to be a risk. Right. You just can't, unfortunately, handle such a rich and a nutritious product without having that risk of contamination. It's always going to be there. And the best we can do is not eliminate that risk unless you're going to use a mitigation process like pasteurization, but to go ahead and educate people that there is going to be a risk there and to take some appropriate steps.
I want to make sure we have time to talk about reasons why people are interested in using raw milk now. But I also know there was another investigation that perhaps we ought to briefly talk about before we go there. Can you summarize the other episode that happened here in Alaska? And this is not unique to Alaska. These reports are happening throughout the country. We're just picking a couple because they're local.
Yeah, so sort of generally, national data from 1998 to 2010 suggests that there were 129 outbreaks associated with raw milk during that time, and both of these ones that we're talking about, Alaska, occurred after that time. And those outbreaks, and Bill can probably mention a couple of these, but the ones in Alaska in the last couple of years have been Campylobacter, but others have been the dreaded E. coli 0157, which is a very dangerous bacteria that can cause, after the infection, can cause kidney failure in a syndrome called hemolytic uremic syndrome. And fortunately, that is not a bacteria that was implicated in this outbreak here. But 2 years ago, in the Matanuska Valley milk that was going to Palmer, Wasil, and Anchorage from another raw milk share caused an outbreak of Campylobacter infections. That were at least 18 illnesses with 7 lab confirmed cases in that summer. And the state and state veterinarian and epidemiology were also collaborating in that investigation. And a couple of those cows, we have reason to believe, went to the current milk share operation as well. So it's, again, it's a relatively small community of people who are interested in drinking raw milk. And in terms of the regulation of cow shares, if you're a part of that loosely defined cow share, then you can drink milk in Alaska. And so people understand that that's the way they're going to have access to raw milk. And so if you want to get it, that's really the way that people are going, and they know the right people to get in touch with to get raw milk.
All right. So let's talk about why. I mean, organic is the word of the 2010 decade, and better, more nutritious, safer might not be one of the descriptive terms. You're a foodborne outbreak expert. Why are people doing it? What are the risks? And let's put this all in some perspective for people.
Well, we'd like to say that there's nothing more natural than manure, but I wouldn't necessarily want to eat it. You're asking kind of the wrong person to talk about why I might want to eat it. I've certainly had people tell me they think it tastes better. Mm-hmm. Just like I would say whole milk, 4% milk, tastes a lot better than skim, but I don't drink it much anymore for other reasons. And part of the taste difference between what people call raw milk, which is that it's not homogenized. So there's a separation of the fat layer will separate from the milk. And of course, you can heat treat milk without homogenizing it. You can pasteurize it, in effect, on your own stovetop. So you can boil or heat your own milk and without getting the homogenization effect. But it's hard to argue with somebody who says it tastes really good. There are a lot of things that are fun to do or taste good, and they may have adverse health consequences.
I'll come back maybe to this issue that I asked more generally, but one of the things that comes to my mind is there's people listening out there that heard about all kinds of foods that we've talked about, chickens and poultry, and I'd add salmon and fish and other things into this mix. Is there a critical temperature that we can give people as an advice that should take care of most of the pathogenic bacteria that we need to worry about? Or is this
Well, the key word's most, but yep. and it the... The properties of these different foods play out in how effective a given temperature is to an effect. But 160 degrees is pretty safe for almost mm-hmm. all the bacteria and parasites and virus. In other words, if you heat something to 160, you're going to kill almost anything that would be in there, knock on wood. And even lower temperatures are highly effective for most of those bugs. So, again, it depends, and it depends not only on the bug but on the food and the medium you're in.
All right. I have a big interest in asthma and allergies. I've had one for a long, long time. And one of the questions is, why is Western society having more allergy and probably more asthma? And there is a predominant hypothesis called the hygiene hypothesis. It says that we're living cleaner. We don't get as many infections. We're not associated with parasites as much. And then that has taken a turn in that people have looked at societies, particularly farm groups in Europe, where unpasteurized food products, untreated food products are commonly eaten. And it appears at this point, particularly with unpasteurized milk, that ingestion of that, particularly early in life, is very much associated, I'm not saying causing, but associated with the less development of allergy. Again, pros and cons, let's get that issue out, because I think there may be people out there that think this is an important issue.
And I think that's definitely something that's out there and that people may well have read about. And it's very interesting. And those data come from largely observational studies where you look at a group of people who have grown up in one set of circumstances, and one of those may include drinking raw milk,
right.
And that may distinguish them from the other group of people. But there might be a lot of other things that distinguish that group of people. And living on the farm itself is thought to potentially increase people's contact with various microbial flora that might give them those exposures that could decrease risks of allergy or asthma later on. So from the reading that I've done, there's no clear evidence from larger studies or kind of more well-recognized types of studies that raw milk would decrease or prevent allergies. But I think that you've kind of hit the nail on the head, is that is one reason why some families seem like they're interested or promoting that as a potential health benefit of raw milk. And other things that I heard just in doing interviews with households who were getting this milk, apart from the taste and the thought that maybe it would help prevent allergies, people thought that maybe it helped people's lactose intolerance and that it had more vitamins. And again, the large studies that have looked at the levels of vitamins between types of milk have really not demonstrated any significant difference in the vitamin levels, and certainly not a difference that in the scope of where the average person is getting most of their vitamins from, that would really affect a person's vitamin levels. We don't see a lot of riboflavin deficiency, fortunately, in the U.S. And so pasteurized milk is a good source of vitamins, but people don't get all of their vitamins from any kind of milk, raw or pasteurized. And in terms of lactose intolerance, there's also just no good data on that. But if any one individual says, when I drank raw milk, it seemed like my symptoms improved, there's certainly no arguing that I would do with that. Each person is their own judge of how they feel when they're drinking something, eating something. But there's just no good scientific data on a larger scale to suggest that those benefits are actually borne out.
It's interesting because one of the studies they did in Wisconsin, and this was in 2004 to 2007, they looked at specifically cases of Campylobacter, foodborne outbreaks associated with the raw milk. And when they went back and they said, one of the arguments that people say when they drink raw milk, it increases their immune system and helps them, fight off this disease. But out of those 198 cases, they ended up having 35 farmers that actually got sick. So and that they constantly drink milk. And so the argument is, well, these people that constantly are exposed to that do get sick from the same foodborne pathogens. And and then, you know, the question is, well, why don't more people get sick? Because they're drinking raw milk. And I think a lot of it has to do with the pathogens aren't always present at a level that they're going to cause problems. There's a lot of variation there. And so that you're always dealing with a situation of risk associated with it. And there's always going to be risk. Sometimes it's going to be higher and lower, depending on the season of the year, the number of animals that are on the farm, the hygiene on the farm, the types of animals that are on the farm that can go ahead and cause a risk there.
We make choices all the time in the foods we eat, and some of those are associated with long-term risk, like chronic disease and heart disease, and others like microbial disease that may get you right away. Eating raw shellfish, right, for example, carries some risk.
Right.
Eating raw meat carries some risk.
Ice cream.
Eating ice cream carries different kinds of risks.
Right.
And again, so drinking raw milk is just one of those things. It's been well established over hundreds of years. There's a potential risk for lots of bugs. The nice thing is there's a process that's very easy and widely available to get pasteurized milk, which is safe to eat, and it's more conveniently available, and frankly, it's cheaper too. So it seems like, to people in public health, like a win-win-win.
Yeah, so it's a be careful out there kind of message.
And a lot of the people that we were able to speak with who were getting, who were subscribing to this raw milk share, made different choices in the aftermath of a child getting an illness, of a whole household getting illness, and decided, you know, I was doing this for things that I thought would be a health benefit, but now I think just my overall impression is that maybe this isn't worth it, or maybe I will pasteurize the milk at home, which a lot of people have decided to
do. And you implied this, or some of the comments you made, this is some of these illnesses are not just vomiting and diarrhea. The vast majority that get salmonella and E. coli and so forth, they're going to have that. But these can be very nasty illnesses, and in particular, I'm thinking of the European outbreak of E. coli, with the strain you were talking about, which I think was associated with sprouts that got associated all over Europe. There were a huge number of deaths associated in renal kidney failure.
Yeah, that was associated with fenugreek sprouts eventually after mistakenly being linked to cucumbers and other products. But we had a raw milk-associated outbreak in Oregon just the beginning of last year that was linked to raw milk, and that was E. coli 0157, and there were half a dozen kids that were hospitalized, three of them for over a month, and two of them with very significant and lifelong impairment that will result.
Yeah, and not to frighten people, but just to be educated, this is the organism we're talking about that people heard about with the McDonald's deal in Seattle a number of years ago.
Jack in the Box.
Jack in the Box. Okay, I don't get
that's right. Bloody diarrhea, if I can say that on the air, but kidney failure, stroke, coma, death. Yep.
So, if you're going to do these things, eat sushi and so forth, be careful out there, you know. Think about what you're doing. All right. Very much appreciate it. Very educational. I think it was great. I hope the listeners got as much out of it as I did. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next week, we will be back. We don't have an absolute program yet. We're talking with a couple of potential guests, so we look forward to having you guys join us. I want to say my thanks to Brian Yablon again, Bob Gerlach, the state veterinarian, and Bill Keen, who got captured just after he was visiting up here trying to have fun, to come in and spend the time with us. So, Bill, thanks very much for doing this. I also want to remind everybody, as usual, Pat Yack is Vice President of Public Media here. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped with audio engineering today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.